Thank you, Alan, for coming on the podcast today. You are a venture capital pioneer and legend, having worked in the industry for more than 50 years. You're the founder of Apax, Greycroft, Primetime Partners, and recently published a book on your life called No Red Lights. So real privilege and a pleasure to have you on the podcast today. I'm very excited for this conversation. I think a very interesting place to start to me, I always like to hear about sort of people's origin stories. And I understand, growing up in New York, your father was an immigrant and you sort of had the entrepreneurial bug very early, selling, I think, newspapers outside of the subway, maybe age 6 years old. I'm curious, how early in your life did you sort of identify this, entrepreneurial trait that you had or the entrepreneurial gene that sort of, was a precursor for a life backing entrepreneurs and becoming one yourself and being one of the very first people to start a venture capital firm?
That's a good question, but, the honest answer is first of all, never even thought about my father as an immigrant, but the word immigrant and immigration is so big today that people really focus on the fact of your origins. But the fact is that, frankly, almost everybody I know had a parent or a grandparent that was, quote, an immigrant, unquote. All our ancestors came from some other place, weren't homegrown. Some were fortunate to have been around here since the Mayflower, but most people I know, family came from Ireland or Russia or what is now Ukraine or some other part of the world. So yes, my father was an immigrant. In terms of entrepreneurial, I never, again, in other words, I never thought of myself as, an entrepreneur or thought about being an entrepreneur. I just think I must have had genes that had an instinct for looking, being curious. I think that would be, more of a word that I would associate with my own proclivities. I mean, I always was curious about, things that were going on around me. And I was, I guess, a natural salesperson. And if you tie the two together, it probably defines an entrepreneur. So, at age six, you're right, I did sell magazines. Don't ask me how I got put out there next to the subway, but I can date exactly because of where I lived and where I moved from at different dates. So I did start early and I did do a lot of things during World War II that you might call entrepreneurial, like collecting tin cans, like collecting newspapers for the war effort and selling savings bonds. And then in college, selling fraternity items, which obviously was a business, and doing all kinds of other things like market research and writing for the local newspapers, all of which were designed to make sufficient funds to pay for my college activities. But after college, I really took a traditional job, which was doing investment research for an investment counseling firm. And I would say I couldn't identify that as an entrepreneurial activity. Although, again, on the side, I sold mutual funds to make up additional income beyond my salary job. So I've always had an instinct to merchandise, to look at the investments. And even during my earliest career, as I was interested in offbeat items, which is actually how I introduced Haloid Xerox into our portfolio, which was an unknown company in the Haloid Corporation up in Rochester, New York, which was starting to replace carbon copies in which was the traditional way of making copies in your office, or either or mimeographing. Those are the two words. So, I guess I had those instincts back to my early job, but my early jobs were in traditional salary jobs doing investment research. It was not until, the late 60s that I started doing more of what I said, looking and being curious and being interested in companies that were earlier in stage and earlier in life, as opposed to being stock market companies, which was my traditional day-to-day activity. But always looking around for private companies or any companies that I thought were doing something unusual. I remember, for example, it comes to mind, I kind of discovered the Velcro Corporation. I can't even remember now whether it was public or private, but I remember that was a unique piece of technology back then. And I guess if I really thought a lot, I could probably come up with other things that I was interested in very early on that were not traditional investing, but traditional investing was the early part of my career after I got out of college until I ultimately, which was 1952, 1955, until I started my own venture capital firm in 1970, when then I was purely focused on entrepreneurial activities.
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of, first of all, that's, you know, really appreciate sort of the context on your early story there. It's really interesting. A lot of these things you mentioned, sort of like the, you know, the word immigrant, the word entrepreneur, you know, you've been at this so long that a lot of the language has changed itself. And, you know, even when you got into venture capital, when you started your firm, I believe it was called Development Capital at that time. So you've been in venture capital longer than venture capital has been venture capital, in a sense. And I think when you made that jump from more traditional investing, it's easy, you know, a lot of people sort of like, it's not easy still, but a lot of people, it's more common that you leave your job, or especially in finance, you leave your firm and you start a new one. But back then, I understand this was far less commonplace. And that was a, you know, very ambitious and audacious move for you. How did you decide, you know, in 1970 or, you know, whatever the year was, to go and actually have the guts to go out on your own and do this?
It did take guts at that time because it was a totally new idea. I got to it in a way logical fashion. I mean, I was just prior to starting my business, I had been managing the investments of a family, not my own, which had a substantial net worth at the time. And they had an off family office. It wasn't, I don't think we even called it a family office, but it was in effect. There were three or four of us, plus a trader and secretaries. And we managed the investments of a family, which, you know, had three sisters and their son-in-laws and their children, which was the first line of succession from the original founder of the firm that originated the capital for investing. And I think today they're up to their fourth generation of ancestors of the original founder. And we invested in traditional stocks just like anyone else, boring, buying IBM or General Motors. No, we weren't doing short selling. We were putting together a portfolio for a family. And I have done that for many years because I had started out in the investment counseling business, doing it for a multiplicity of families, a firm that served families. But I was working with one specific family. And what would happen is that the man who headed up this operation really knew a lot of the moguls of Wall Street at the time who ran all the investment banking firms. And they would every once in a while get a private investment opportunity, whether it was the head of Lehman Brothers or Goldman Sachs or Wertheim, names that probably in some cases are not even around anymore. It was not J.P. Morgan or Morgan Stanley, but it was Lehman Brothers was probably one of the major sources. Hallgarden, Bogle, Rowland and Stone. These were the firms that would originate a lot of private deals. They were traditional brokerage firms, but they would, you know, when people wanted to raise money for a private deal, who else would you go to but the investment firms? And they would then circulate these among their big clients, and we were one of them. And every once in a while, we would put money into one of these deals, and what would happen is they'd put it in a paper file drawer, because everything was paper then, and no one really paid any attention to it. It was like the background noise, because there were very small percentages. Most of the money was put into the paper, public paper companies, or traditional portfolio stocks. And I was the only person who had any interest in what was going into this file drawer, and made it my business to kind of get to know some of these companies. And in several cases, I started initiating investing in this area. And at some point, I realized that there were a lot of family groups around that were doing traditional investments, but did not have anyone in their operations that had the interest in these private type deals, but they were part of every family group's portfolio. There were certain family groups like the Lehman family, like Loeb Rhodes, like as you probably know, the Phipps family, Rockefellers, who really made it a business to be in this kind of activity as a specialization. I don't know, they didn't call themselves venture capital firms, but they were handling the private portfolios for these family groups. They were really organized to make this type of investment. And so I thought, gee, you know, there's a real opportunity to start a business for the families that don't have this capability internally. And maybe I can assemble a group of them on retainer and get an annual fee that would form the basis of a business, and get a percentage of the profits when they actually made the investment. It would be optional. So you might call it not a pledge fund, but a pledge association of clients. And I set out to get 10 clients like this that were all families. And what I ended up doing was getting 9, and then the 10th client became a very small $2.5 million kitty, I would have called it, but it was a fund that was kind of a kitty, so that if I was looking at a deal and none of the family groups wanted to participate, I would at least have some capability to invest without their approval. And that's what I did. And actually, some of those people who participated in that very first kitty, as I called it, I call it now, are still actually investors of mine. And after my forming Alan Patrickoff Associates, and then which became Apex, and then Graycroft, and now Primetime, and I still have a couple of investors in Primetime that were investors of mine 50 years ago, 52 years ago, which is pretty remarkable. First, that they're still alive, and second, that they're still investing in these types of deals. So it's been a long journey, but it started out with that and morphed over a period of time when I found that really was not sustainable. You couldn't just have these family groups at their whim deciding when they would go follow up with an investment or when they would come up with an idea that I could pursue from their origination, and that I needed a more permanent, sustainable pool of capital. And from that, original tiny fund of $2.5 million, I started raising funds and gradually replaced the families with only funds under management. And those families, some of them, I don't remember if all of them, but some of them, most of them, they became investors in these funds that I started, sometime after the first one.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I don't know, the $2.5 million in 1970 sounds like a good chunk of change to me. So for starting your first fund, it's not too bad, I don't think. But
It was not terrific, I tell you that, because I remember, for example, that I looked at the first investment in Federal Express, and we did all the analysis. I actually had enough money from the retainers and the fund management to have two or three people working and a secretary or two, and none of us made a lot of money in those early days. Just barely scraped by, but we did all the work on Federal Express and decided that we would get wiped out in a, all we could do was a maximum of 10%, which was 250,000. We couldn't really interest the other family groups, so I said we're just going to have to pass. As good as the idea may be, there's going to be too many subsequent rounds. It turned out there were, I think, four rounds. The first and second round got wiped out, and the last round, fourth private round, probably did well. But because we had done the work and knew what was going on, we actually made our first public investment whenever it was that Federal Express went public, and made a venture return from that public investment, actually. But it was because of the background we had developed in the very, very earliest days of actually when I was there, when the day Federal Express started. Don't ask me what date it was, but whatever it was, I was there.
Yeah, and I know, obviously there's a bunch of big name companies that have sort of you've crossed paths with over the years, none bigger than, of course, Apple. And I know you get asked about Apple all the time, and there's not too much of a story there. It's kind of like a lucky situation. But I actually want to sort of ask about that luck itself. So sort of take like a kind of unique angle on this. Like basically my understanding is you got a call from sort of a friend who had this allocation, and this was like pre-IPO Apple, so not like day one or anything like that, but pre-IPO, it was enough to sort of 20x, I think, by the time of IPO, and then, continue to make better returns beyond that, holding most of your stake. So I think it's sort of, if I can maybe stretch an analogy, it goes sort of with the theme of your book, No Red Lights, where you're just sort of keeping your head up on opportunities and saying yes to interesting things. And for all the work you did over, 50 years of venture capital trying to identify the best early opportunities, Apple of all companies kind of like falls in your lap. Do you think like sort of there's an approach that you were able to, take over the years that sort of increased your ability to either attract these sort of lucky opportunities or if not to attract them, perhaps to recognize them at least when they appeared?
Recognize them, yes. Fall in your lap. I think that has a lot to do with, well, I guess it has to do with recognizing. I mean, if you go back to my word of curiosity, if you keep your eyes open and you look and see what's happening and they're watching new developments, you don't necessarily need to have it fall into your lap and someone call you up on the telephone, but rather being prescient enough to spot trends, which doesn't happen that often, and you can't always take advantage of it. I mean, for example, we have the latest revolution in, as I call it, which is AI, and you have to play with very, very big dollars. And in the old days, you could get involved with trends with a lot less money than it probably takes today for some of the exciting new breakthrough technologies. For example, particularly in the biotech area, I mean, you can't do that casually with a limited amount of capital, which is one reason why I stay away from it today in prime time. We don't have enough capital to play in that game.
Mentioned the AI revolution, and I heard you talk about how through all the revolutions you've seen over your career as a VC, this is actually seems like the greatest in terms of like the most impactful. Could you sort of rewind as someone there's few people who have not only lived through but been intimately involved with so many of these technological revolutions from mainframes to personal computers and the internet and mobile. Could you pick any of those that you'd sort of be most keen to talk about and sort of compare them maybe to each other or to this AI revolution, and why you see such sort of extreme, you know, forward movement from this AI revolution that's upcoming and in process?
I think the AI revolution, which is my word, I don't know if anyone else would call it that, but I think it's had such, it transcends virtually everything that I've seen beforehand, because we have no idea where it's going to go, and it transcends every industry. And it really, what it basically says is the information that's been accumulated by the world, whatever sources it may be, whatever has happened to date, although ChatGPT, I guess, goes to 2021, but that'll change pretty soon, is now open to access to do whatever one wants to do. I actually, of all the quote revolutions, I mean, I was there at the beginning of the PC revolution. I mean, I was there for all of them. I mean, I was there for the beginning of the disk drive revolution, the storage revolution, the biotech revolution. But I guess I was part of every one of them. I guess the one I was really took advantage of was the cellular revolution, which took place in 1982, because the government initially had a lottery for giving away spectrum for mobile industry. I mean, it's just hard to believe today when you know what spectrum is being sold for. But in those days, AT&T and Motorola were the leading people in wireless carriers, estimated that ultimately, there would be a 2% penetration. And I think today we've probably got closer to 90 or even 100%, because a lot of people have two phones. But, you know, you could get into that business for a relatively limited amount of money, which is what we raised to start the first cellular company I invested in, which became a very, very big company. And so, on reflection, I have to say, you know, I was there when Genentech got started. I was there when Miniscribe got started. I mean, I've seen them all. I didn't have the opportunity in the when Google or Facebook started. I didn't have an opportunity to invest in those companies. I mean, it just didn't come to my attention. I wasn't excluded, but I wasn't, you know, it just didn't surface until much later on. But now we're in a new revolution that I think, as I say, transcends all of them. It's very exciting. And I think the way to play that is going to be to take advantage of artificial intelligence, machine learning, whatever it may be, to use that as a tool in whatever area one may be in. So employing those tools may be the real next revolution. Someone who, you know, it'll be an application.
Right. So you've spoke to sort of some of the differences between these various revolutions over time, one of them being how expensive it is to participate in one as an investor these days versus what it was, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. But I'm curious, you know, what might have been some of the commonalities between these revolutions? And one way to think about that could be, you know, for each of these revolutions, did you sort of know them when they came, or did some of them sneak up on you more so than others? And were there others that seemed like revolutions that sort of fizzled out and never panned out?
Well, some businesses took so little capital ultimately that so many people, you know, started competitive companies in the early stages that the small companies where we would have participated got wiped out or long forgotten. Cellular was unique, I think. And so I relate to that. Internet, the people who've made money mostly in the internet have really been applications, knowing how to write on top of the internet, the access it gave you. And I think that not necessarily the original person who developed the first technology out of the University of Chicago, but I think that it'll be, and Marc Andreessen was very, very early, for example, in that, having been there, as I believe. But I think that in AI, I think everybody's going to have an opportunity in some way to participate in a particular area to take advantage of what you're able to do with this new technology.
Yeah, so I do want to. I mean, it's fascinating to talk venture capital with you, and especially the history and sort of the, like I said earlier, not many people have been able to witness, let alone be so intimately involved in all of these sort of shifts in technology and the world more broadly. But I do want to talk about longevity because you're quite impressive on a personal, level with you're 88 years old, evidently very sharp, and just getting started with your, third big fund with Primetime Partners, which we'll talk about. But I think an interesting a question to ask, maybe to convert from sort of like your story to this longevity piece, is around sort of the people you've surrounded yourself with. Like you mentioned earlier, you've had some limited partners in your fund Primetime now who were some of your first investors when you went and started, Alan Patricoff Associates back in the day. And so I sort of have a, maybe a shot in the dark question, but I wonder if there's any, if you've sort of experienced that there's any like contagiousness with longevity, if some of the people you've sort of brought into your life and kept around you over the years or spent time with have, if longevity can be contagious in any way. And then, well, yeah, maybe we could start there. And then I have another sort of related question.
Well, I don't know. I don't want to follow your path of contagion. I would just say that I think there are a lot more people around today who are older, who are still healthy, still active. I hate to bring politics in, but including the president, our current president, who are, able to contribute at a age where, 50 years ago they would have long, long since been retired, or dead, and probably more likely dead, because the age expectation has grown so enormously over the years. But with the advent of even just take running, which was non-existent. Back in the 60s, no one ran, only kind of started in the 70s. The first marathon in New York was had 125 people. I was in the third or fourth one, which went four times around Central Park, and I don't know how many were in it then, maybe 400 or 500, but today there are 50,000. I think that will give you an idea, and that relates to health. And no one had a trainer, or went to gym. There were no, there, you know, none of the gyms that we see around, whether it's Crunch or Exhale or whatever fitness company, no one was even thinking about this kind of a membership back in those early days. Between exercise and between conscious of what people are eating, and also getting involved with a lot of organizations that are specifically formed to try to extend life. We have a whole different set of circumstances that were there that are different than what existed at that, 50 years ago or even 40 years ago. So I can't say contagion, but you can use Warren Buffett as a good example. You can use the president as a good example. You can use me as a case book. I'm not the only person around, in his late 80s who's still active. and about to get married again. My wife passed away a few years ago of Alzheimer's. No one, I can't imagine someone in their at my age in 1970, even then, thinking about getting remarried in their late 80s. But life, as you may know, I'm going to live to 114, or at least I think so. But people are living longer. By 2030, there'll be more people over 100 than there are under 18, which presents problems and opportunities for serving those people. But I think that we just have a whole set of circumstances today that have presented the opportunity. While at one hand, companies are having forcing early retirement, including, I'm so sorry to say, I had nothing to do with it, my old firm Apax, which has you retiring at 60. But there are many leaders around of countries, governments, and companies that are well along in their 70s and still very, very actively producing very positive results. So I think that there's a kind of a dichotomy of what of people living longer and more of us and what to do because they're going to stay active longer. They got to take care of them longer, and it does create a an issue, which is why Apax went to a 60 retirement to make room for other people. So, there's a push me, pull me aspect in there.
Yeah, I mean, I love your approach to life and, being 88 and getting married again. I think, you'll be 89 by then, maybe, and you're expecting to have a 25-year marriage and live to 114. And I know when I first heard that on a podcast, I was dying to know, where 114 came from. It seems very random. But then in your book, you talk about, I guess it was a gerontologist at Mount Sinai who explained that the human body, absent any major illness, is designed to live to 114. And I like that story too, because I think there's a lot to be said for the power of belief. And if you can just sort of get a point, hear a supporting point or some evidence that sounds like something you want to believe in, you can sort of take it at face value and choose to believe in that. And that belief in and of itself, I think, can go a long way towards sort of
It propels
making it
you,
become a
absolutely.
reality. Yeah.
If you believe it, if you don't believe it, it's not going to happen. And you have to have some belief. And I personally think that today, if someone went to that same gerontologist, and I don't know who it was, I don't know if he's alive, but because it was at least 15 years ago when I heard that, I
Only
think that
he,
same
if
lecture
he,
would probably say 120 today.
yeah, if he believed what he was saying, he should be alive. But maybe, I don't know. Hopefully he did. So I think I'm curious also to discuss sort of some of your keys to longevity over the years and the evolution of it. You mentioned, obviously you were running back before, when running was just sort of early becoming a thing, and marathons probably seemed like a crazy idea at that time when you participated in, the third or fourth New York Marathon. So obviously started out with running, but did you sort of add sort of rules and habits over time? I know now you're like a huge walker, walking basically everywhere you go. Obviously, New York makes that feasible. I wish a lot of other cities were more walkable, like New York. I think it could do a lot for sort of average longevity and everything like that. I know you have some other interesting habits, like sort of weighing yourself twice a day. And if you weigh a couple pounds over what you're supposed to be, you skip your next meal, you split every meal when you go out to dinner with your partner. Curious to hear sort of how these things came to be. Like, you didn't just wake up one day and decide, like, these are my seven rules. Probably they developed over time. So I'm curious about the evolution as you went from, your early 20s to where you are today.
Well, I again use the word curious. I guess it was curious. I mean, I didn't take anything for granted. I mean, I got to the splitting meals by the fact that I was taking out this woman who I'm going to marry, and she picked at every meal and just, dabbled on it and had a bite and left everything sitting around. And I said, "This is crazy. I'm paying for a dinner and she's not eating it, and I'm being given too much to eat because I believe that restaurants serve too large a portion." I said, "From now on, we're going to split a dinner." And it turned out to be a perfect solution because she, when it was a much smaller amount on her plate, she finished it all, and I had more than enough to satisfy me. I hadn't even realized that I was just eating. You're given a veal piccata, and there are three pieces on the plate. You finish them all. When you're given it with only one or one and a half, you are perfectly satisfied and don't overstuff yourself. And that's how the eating habit came. The weighing was that how was I going to control my getting heavier? And I said, the only way I'm going to do it is by really being on top of my weight. And I did. I monitored by having a scale wherever I am. I have several scales in the house that I have in my home in the country, and I just, it's not addiction. I just, before I go to bed, I look, and when I get up, I look, and it hasn't changed. If during the day I increased more than a couple of pounds, I would just skip a meal the next day. It was easy to do. And I started being much more conscious of it. I also went to a clinic of one of the companies we've invested in at Primetime called it's called Cenogenics. They have about 20 clinics around the country, and I went through the whole process and did by analyzing biomarkers and such. I knew what nutraceuticals or hormones I needed to ask add. Unfortunately, I shouldn't even say this, but I was disappointed. I thought I would be testosterone deficient, but it turned out that I was in good shape, which disappointed me. Because as you get older, certainly your whole sexual appetites change. And I was expecting a shot of testosterone, which was going to change me for the next 25 years. That's an aside. But I started saying, instead of taking cabs every place, I actually, New York is small enough, you can walk almost every place. Why not do it? Which is the best exercise you can do. I've also had a trainer, which I write about in the book, for 25 years. And actually, since the book was written, he retired from training, and I've had to get a new trainer, but I'm, disciplined and taking training a couple of times a week, which helps to keep you fit. And if I didn't do that, I would probably belong to some gym. And you combine all those things, and then having a very active lifestyle. I'm not sedentary, so I think the formula I have is a perfect one. By the way, when I did marathon running for many years, then as I got older, I evolved into rollerblading, which was a very popular. It's still much less today, but I started doing that, and then I got hurt rollerblading, and so I started taking a bike riding and walking. Running is harder for me now because I really had a very serious tear in my hamstring, so I really am doing jogging and walking is how I did the marathon last year. As I say, I could have easily stopped after the marathon, but I did rollerblading and biking, and I still bike ride. And I think if you're an active person, you have a positive attitude, you do the right thing in times of trying to prevent diseases from happening. I've had my share of diseases. I had prostate cancer 15 or 20 years ago. I've had a hip replacement 15 years ago. But those don't permanently kill you, thank God. And I'm fortunate that I have, I guess guess I'm, my heart's in pretty good condition, and all the, my vital signs are excellent. So I can really believe my own story of where I think I'm going to end up. If I don't, people could come and laugh.
Yeah, I mean, it's very inspiring stuff. And, you know, I guess if you can hire a trainer when they're pretty young and continue using them until it's their time to retire, you're doing something pretty good. That's probably going to bode pretty well. And congrats on the marathon. Just amazing. And I don't know how many other people your age have been able to accomplish that, but it's got to be a relatively short list. I want to, you know, before we run out of time, definitely talk about Primetime, your newest firm, which we sort of alluded to earlier. Started it in 2020. You were 86 at the time. I think the initial fund was $50 million. So now you're a few years into your third act. And the focus is on aging and longevity and products that make life better and healthier and longer for people in their 50s, 60s, and beyond. Definitely a shared passion, you know, of mine and a lot of listeners to this podcast who might be interested in sort of the more radical side of longevity of can we actually slow and reverse aging itself rather than, you know, attacking each individual disease? Can we go after the process of aging and therefore sort of put off a lot of these diseases, which are sort of the main risk factor is aging itself, that you don't expect to get these diseases in your 40s and whatnot. So what was the sort of inspiration for the firm and the thesis for it? And, you know, how is it going so far?
Well, for the minor correction, I was 85 when I started, but that very minor. And I, my wife had had Alzheimer's. I forget at that time she passed away in early 2020. But she'd had it for 12 years beforehand. So I had been living with that particular disease for a long time. And when you're living with that, you learn a lot about what supplies you need, what opportunities there are for diagnosis, what caregiving is available. And I got to know a lot of the organizations that were servicing people with problems, neurological problems, not just Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's is, people use that word as a general word, but it's really one disease. I mean, you've got Alzheimer's, you've got senility, you've got Parkinson's, you've got Lewy bodies. Alzheimer's starts with something they call aphasia. So I learned about a lot of that. And I read a lot of the stuff I've talked to you about trends of aging. And I said, you know, I was decided to phase out of Graycroft. I thought that, you know, what was I going to do? I mean, I wanted to do something interesting. And I saw these demographic trends and the fact that nobody really was focusing on that in terms of an investment thesis. So I was talking about it. All I did was talk. And then my son came to me and said, you know, this Abby Levy, who had gone to Harvard Business School with him, had the same idea. She was going to do something. She was about to start a fund, de novo, because she had not been in the investment business before. She had been managing companies and marketing and consumer acquisition. And I knew her reasonably well because we were both on the board of Arianna Huffington's company, Thrive Global. I had been originally in Huffington Post. And then when Arianna set up her second company, I got involved with that. And Abby had been the founding president of that. Arianna was CEO. And then she left there to go to SoulCycle. And I only saw her at board meetings. And my son said, you ought to get together. We got together in a matter of a few days. And about a couple of weeks later, we started a fund. I came up with the name Primetime. We went out, talked to a limited number of people and decided we'd start with a small amount of money rather than spend, you know, 9 months or a year trying to get a lot larger and see what opportunities we could develop. And we also both agreed that we wanted to become thought leaders in kind of these kind of conversations, whether it's podcasts or television or any kind of media or conferences, to talk about aging and longevity. And I think we've really accomplished that, or maybe we wouldn't even be here today if we hadn't. We've made Primetime known as one of the leading people investing in this area, even with a relatively small fund. And we've seen literally, I'm not exaggerating, I think we're up to 1,400 opportunities for investment. We've invested in a little over 30. You know, we tried to be selective. We brought in a team of two other younger people with us. Abby is half my age. We've made a dent in this area, and we're, you know, thinking about what we're going to do for Fund Two, whether we'll do it, when we'll do it, with whom we'll do it. We, you know, it's still a nascent area. Our investments have been all over the place, which is exactly what we intended. It was going to be horizontal. In other words, it was aging, longevity, and it wasn't, you know, finance or health or consumer. It's all of the above, but the key defining principle was it had to be, whatever anyone was doing, it had to be to serve the aging population. You can say that's over 60, maybe, you know, there's no, we don't have a specific cutoff, but I can assure you it's not, there are no fast delivery companies for millennials or college students. We pretty much stuck to our, what we intended, and have a very diversified portfolio, a strong balance, imbalance, you might say, towards health, because that's the biggest area of focus. And we, you know, already can see a few emerging, you know, the Belmont Stakes. We can see a few thoroughbreds out in front, and you know, one or two way in the back who haven't got a chance. You know, that's the nature of a seed and pre-seed and A round portfolio. It takes time. You know, it's like art history. It doesn't happen overnight. It takes a while to develop. So, you know, I think we'll see the fruits of our results, of our efforts, probably in the next several years. You know, until then, I think we're not going to see our companies get bought or go public in the short term. We're building, you know, some strong businesses, and we'll, you know, tune in a couple of years from now to see what the results are. So far, it's encouraging.
Yeah, I'm definitely excited to see where it all goes. And I'm conscious of the fact that we only have 5 or 6 minutes left here. So I want to wrap it up with maybe one final question. You mentioned in the book how, you know, more than any business accomplishment, one of, you know, probably your most proud thing that you've ever done was building a cohesive family unit. In somewhat of challenging setup situation as well, with you know, having your first son with your first wife, and then, you know, your following children with your second wife, and making that all work, and having a really close family, and you know, going down to your grandkids and everything like that. So I'm curious, for people who maybe more like my age or younger and just getting started with a family, if you have any sort of principles or you know, advice, things to keep in mind for people to sort of build strong families from, you know, from the get-go.
I just think you want to be have a balanced life. You know, the message in my book, No Red Lights, which I hope all your listeners will buy on Amazon, or I recorded it, by the way, for Audible, which is one of the companies I actually started, ironically. Maybe not ironically, and maybe naturally, because it was in the media world, and I did a lot of investments in the media world during my career. I've always had a very strong sense of family concern from day one, and I've tried to be, you know, attend events, which is not simple, particularly when, you know, your career is trying to grow and you've got multiple children who are doing multiple talented things. And of course, now I've got seven grandchildren to try to follow. But I think if you make the effort, you can do it. It's not simple, but it's the same thing of, getting interested in theater, getting interested in dance, getting interested in reading. I think you to be an interesting person and build an interesting life, you have to be multifaceted. And I think that family is absolutely part of it, and being dedicated husband. And although every there has to be sacrifices someplace, and you have to have an understanding wife and family as part of trying to build a business, but you have to be understanding and trying to be responsive to the family needs. And I one thing I always did is I it's hard, much much harder today to do than it was when it was lesser numbers in the family, was we always did family trips every year, and that was a very cohesive event. We also always and after everyone was married and such, we tried to have the family all together for a couple of weeks in the summer. So we, I was very always very sensitive to it. And I had a wife who was very, very dedicated to the family, and took my part in a lot of things. I think both of you, both parties can't be, actively in building their own business. That's pretty tough. But someone has to sacrifice something, and we're seeing a lot of instances today where the man sacrifices for a woman's career, which is a very positive thing. And I'm a big believer in women entrepreneurs. I backed a lot of them, and as you can see, I've had, by the way, a woman partner in the original formation of Alan Patrick Hafizoghi, not necessarily on day one, but on day one and for Graycroft and day one for Primetime, I've had a woman partner, and they've had families that they had to deal with as we built the business. So everyone has to be respectful of the other's obligations. You want to be certainly in an environment where there's an understanding about family obligations. And I think society and business life today is much, much more open-minded about people's family and business life and how they meld together, particularly since COVID, where people are spending a lot more time at home. That's kind of taking care of, it's taking care of family life by itself.
Yeah, I think it's all very admirable, and you see a lot of people build great businesses, but it comes at a cost. It comes at a cost of the family or the health, and you're crushing it on both fronts and really all three over your long and successful career. So it's very admirable and inspiring, and I think that's a great place to end. I appreciate Alan you coming on the podcast today. It was wonderful speaking with you, and yeah, for those listening in, go and buy the book No Red Lights on Amazon, or listen to Alan read it himself on Audible, which is one of his better investments. So thank you, Alan, again, and appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.